risking national bankruptcy to buy a desert. Angry partisanship was the order of the day. Senator John Quincy Adams complained in his diary, "The country is so totally given up to the spirit of party that not to follow blindfold the one or the other is an inexpiable offense." But the New England Federalists were putting themselves on the wrong side of history to oppose the purchase. One denounced it as a great curse, and another feared that the purchase threatens, at no very distant day, the subversion of our Union. Caspar Wister of Philadelphia, Lewis's sometime tutor, got it right. He wrote to congratulate Jefferson on the very happy acquisitions you have made for our country. Although no one here appears to know the extent or price of the cession, it is generally considered as the most important and beneficial transaction which has occurred since the Declaration of Independence, and next to it, most like to influence or regulate the destinies of our country. One immediate effect of the purchase was to change Lewis's relationship with the Indian tribes he would encounter east of the Divide. The Indians were now on American territory. Lewis would be responsible for informing them that their great father was Jefferson rather than the Spanish and French rulers. Jefferson wanted Lewis to bring them into the trading net of the United States, which meant bringing peace among them and telling the British around the Mandan villages that they were on foreign soil. By far, the most important effect of the purchase on the expedition was a negative that stemmed from the fact that no one knew what the boundaries of Louisiana were. Napoleon sold Louisiana with the same extent that it now has in the hands of Spain and that it had when France possessed it. The general belief was that Louisiana consisted of the western half of the Mississippi drainage. That meant from the Gulf of Mexico northward to the northernmost tributaries of the Missouri, and from the Mississippi westward to the Continental Divide. But no American, Spaniard, Frenchman, or Briton knew how far north that was. Jefferson, greatly excited by the prospect of adding more northern territory to the purchase, at once began urging Lewis to explore those northern tributaries, where earlier, in the formal instructions, he had emphasized exploration of the southern tributaries. Jefferson wanted land. He wanted empire. He reached out to seize what he wanted, first of all by continually expanding the boundaries of Louisiana. Diplomatic historian Thomas Maitland Marshall describes it well. Starting with the idea that the purchase was confined to the western waters of the Mississippi Valley, Jefferson's conception had gradually expanded until, by 1808, it included West Florida, Texas, and the Oregon Country, a view which was to be the basis of a large part of American diplomacy for nearly half a century. Lewis started out for Pittsburgh on July 5, 1803, the day after the news of the purchase arrived. Although he was in a good mood, he had a great deal to be worried about. Would Clark accept, or would his health or business commitments prevent him from joining? Had the wagon load of supplies gotten from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh? Had the weapons and other items selected at Harper's Ferry been sent to Pittsburgh? Had he selected the right items in sufficient quantity? What kind of soldiers would be meeting him in Pittsburgh for the trip down the Ohio? Was the keelboat he had ordered made in Pittsburgh completed? He had a sense of urgency. Having used up more than a month of good traveling weather, he knew the Ohio River would be falling as summer wore on, knew that he had to get going if he were to have any hope of making any significant distance up the Missouri before the weather closed in. But he still had a great deal to do in Harper's Ferry and Pittsburgh. So he could not have been altogether easy in his mind as he turned his horse's head west and started out. But he must have had a joy in his heart. He certainly had a determination. With that first step west, he intended never to look back until he had reached the Pacific. Lewis got to Fredericktown, present Frederick, Maryland, the evening of July 5th. There was good news. The wagon carrying supplies from Philadelphia had passed through Fredericktown 10 days earlier. There was bad news. On arrival at Harper's Ferry, the driver had decided the arms and other weapons Lewis had ordered were too heavy for his team, so he had gone on to Pittsburgh without them. Lewis hired a teamster in Fredericktown, who promised he would be in Harper's Ferry by July 8th. Lewis pushed on to Harper's Ferry, where "I shot my guns and examined the several articles which had been manufactured for me at this place. They appeared to be well executed." What pleased him most was the completed iron frame boat. But good feelings gave way to worries. The teamster disappointed me. Lewis hired another, locally. The man promised to load up the guns and the iron frame and the rest and be on his way to Pittsburgh early the next morning. Lewis then set off for Pittsburgh, where he arrived at 2 o'clock p.m. on July 15th. He immediately wrote a report to Jefferson so as to catch the 5 o'clock p.m. post. It had been hot and dry, the roads extremely dusty, yet I feel myself much benefited by the exercise the journey has given me, and can with pleasure announce, so far, and all is well. Though the Ohio was low, it could be navigated if he could get a quick start. He had not yet had time to see the boat he had ordered. The boat contract called for completion on July 20th, but to Lewis's intense disappointment, the builder wasn't even close to done. The contractor claimed he had found it difficult to get the proper timber, but now it had arrived, and he promised to have the work completed by July 30th. Lewis reported to Jefferson that he was by no means sanguine that he could meet that date. August 5th was more like it. "I visit him every day," Lewis wrote, "and endeavor by every means in my power to hasten the completion of the work. I have prevailed on him to engage more hands. I shall embark immediately. The boat is in readiness." Some good news. The wagon from Harper's Ferry arrived on July 22nd. So had the party of 7 recruits. The 8th recruit had pocketed his bounty for enlisting and promptly deserted. From Carlisle, who would make the descent of the Ohio with a keelboat. But what nagged was the falling river. "The current of the Ohio is extremely low and continues to decline," Lewis told Jefferson. "This may impede my progress, but shall not prevent my proceeding, being determined to get forward, though I should not be able to make a greater distance than a mile per day." The next week was agony for Lewis. The boat builder was a drinking man, so he seldom worked mornings, and sometimes not in the afternoons either. He had none of Lewis's sense of urgency, but there was no one else in Pittsburgh capable of doing the work. So Lewis fretted and fumed, but did not fire the contractor. On July 29th, the mail brought in the best possible news. It was a letter from Clark. He had accepted. "The enterprise, etc., is such as I have long anticipated and am much pleased with," Clark wrote, "and as my situation in life will admit of my absence the length of time necessary to accomplish such an undertaking, I will cheerfully join you in an official character, as mentioned in your letter, and partake of the dangers, difficulties, and fatigues, and I anticipate the honors and rewards of the result of such an enterprise. This is an undertaking freighted with many difficulties, but, my friend, I do assure you that no man lives with whom I would prefer to undertake such a trip, etc., as yourself." He asked Lewis to tell Jefferson to send his commission on to Louisville, across the river from Clarksville. He said he would try to find a few good men for the expedition, which he reported was the chief subject of conversation in Louisville. In a follow-up letter of July 24th, Clark related that "several young men, gentlemen's sons, have applied to accompany us, as they are not accustomed to labor, and as that is a very essential part of the services required of the party, I am cautious in giving them any encouragement." He told Lewis he would be ready to go as soon as the keelboat reached Louisville, for he, too, was eager to get as far up the Missouri as possible that season. "My friend," he concluded, "I join you with hand and heart." "I feel myself much gratified with your decision," Lewis told Clark by the next post, August 3rd, "for I could neither hope, wish, or expect from a union with any man on earth more perfect support or further aid in the discharge of the several duties of my mission than that which I am confident I shall derive from being associated with yourself." Lewis said he was pleased that Clark had engaged some men and reminded him that this was their most critical job. "The enterprise must depend on a judicious selection of our men. Their qualifications should be such as perfectly fit them for the service. Otherwise, they will rather clog than further the objects in view. On this principle, I am well pleased that you have not admitted or encouraged the young gentleman you mention. We must set our faces against all such applications and get rid of them on the best terms we can. They will not answer our purposes." Clark absolutely agreed. On August 21st, he informed Lewis that, "I have had many applications from stout, likely fellows, but have refused to retain some and put others off with the promise of giving an answer after I see or heard from you." Lewis was simultaneously being pestered by young men in Pittsburgh who wanted to join up. Clearly, the word was out in the Western country, and what young, unmarried frontiersmen, whether gentlemen's sons or the sons of whiskey-making corn farmers, could resist such an opportunity? It was the ultimate adventure. The reward for success would be a land grant, similar to those given the Revolutionary War veterans, a princely reward to frontiersmen. So Lewis and Clark could be highly selective. Clark was an excellent judge of men. He had gathered seven of the best young woodsmen and hunters in this part of the country. These were the men awaiting Lewis's approval before being accepted. They included Charles Floyd, Nathaniel Pryor, William Bratton, Reuben Field, Joseph Field, George Gibson, and John Shields. Lewis was equally good as a judge. In Pittsburgh, he selected John Coulter and George Shannon, at 18 the youngest of the group, subject to Clark's approval. The boat builder was guilty of unpardonable negligence, Lewis charged. August 5th came and went, and only one side of the boat was partially planked. In desperation, Lewis thought of purchasing two or three pirogues. It is impossible to tell what he meant by this, as he used the words pirogue and canoe interchangeably. A pirogue is a flat-bottomed dugout designed for marshes and shallow waters, most popular today among Louisiana duck hunters. The pirogues Lewis had in mind, however, were much larger, and possibly not dugouts at all, but big flat-bottomed masted rowboats built from planks. A canoe is a round or curved bottom craft, either dug out of the trunk of a large tree or built to a frame and covered with bark or skins, most popular today for recreation on large, fast rivers. When Lewis said canoe, however, what he meant was a round-bottomed dugout much larger than today's sporting canoes. In his anxiety to get going, and with his doubt that the boat builder would ever complete the keelboat, Lewis was proposing to descend the Ohio River in pirogues until he could find a keelboat somewhere downriver to purchase. But when the local merchants told him there was no place to procure a boat below, and the boat builder promised to be done by August 13th, Lewis abandoned the fantasy and waited and fumed. 4 days later, the builder got drunk and quarreled with his workmen, several of whom quit on the spot. Lewis threatened him with a canceled contract, but there wasn't much reality to the threat. The boat builder had no competition within hundreds of miles. The builder did give a promise of greater sobriety, but this lasted less than a week. Lewis charged that he was continuing to be constantly either drunk or sick. Lewis spent most of his time at the worksite, alternately persuading and threatening. He soothed himself some by buying a dog and naming it Seaman. He paid $20 for the Newfoundland, a large black dog. Each day the river sank a bit lower. It got so bad that Lewis was told, "The river is lower than it has ever been known by the oldest settler in this country." The delays all but drove him mad, but they had to be endured because the job had to be done right. After all, Lewis was proposing to descend the Ohio, then ascend the Mississippi to the mouth of the Missouri, then ascend the Missouri to the Mandan villages in that boat. A lot of thought had gone into it, requiring skilled woodworking. The complexity of the thing must have been some part of the cause of the delay. Lewis had designed it, and he oversaw its construction and probably made modifications in the plans as the work progressed. It was basically a galley, little resembling the classic keelboat of the West. It seems to have been the standard type of vessel for use on inland waters at the outset of the 19th century, especially for military purposes. Lewis probably had been on a similar keelboat on the Ohio when he was a paymaster. It was 55 feet long, 8 feet wide at midships, with a shallow draft. It had a 32-foot-high mast that was joined near the base so it could be lowered. The mast could support a large square sail and a foresail. A 10-foot-long deck at the bow provided a forecastle. An elevated deck of 10 feet at the stern accommodated a cabin. The hold was 31 feet in length and could carry a cargo of about 12 tons. Crossing the deck were 11 benches, each 3 feet long, for use by two oarsmen. The boat could be propelled by four methods: rowing, sailing, pushing, and pulling. In pushing, the crew set long poles in the river bottom and pushed on them as they walked front to rear on the boat. Men or horses or ox used ropes for pulling, sometimes from the water, sometimes from the shore. To hurry the builder along, Lewis tried getting on his knees. He tried shouting and cursing. But neither threats, persuasion, or any other means which I could devise were sufficient to procure the completion of the work sooner than the 31st of August. He had hoped to be on his way by July 20th, at the latest by August 1st. By the time the boat was ready, the river had fallen so low that those who pretend to be acquainted with the navigation of the river declare it impracticable to descend it. Lewis was going anyway. How anxious he was to get going, he demonstrated on the morning of August 31st. The last nail went into the planking at 7 o'clock a.m. By 10 o'clock a.m., Lewis had the boat loaded. To keep it as high in the water as possible, he shipped a considerable quantity of goods by wagon to Wheeling. In addition, he purchased a pirogue to carry as much as possible to further lighten the load. He intended to purchase another at Wheeling to carry the goods coming by land. Then he was on his way. Chapter 9. Down the Ohio. September to November 1803. Lewis had proceeded only 3 miles when he pulled over at an island and at the request of the pioneers living on it gave a demonstration of his air gun, purchased from gunsmith Isaiah Lukens of Philadelphia. It was a pneumatic rifle. The stock was the reservoir, and it could be pumped full of air to a pressure of 500 to 600 PSI, at which point it was not much inferior in hitting power to the Kentucky rifle. That it produced no smoke or noise astonished the frontiersmen. Lewis fired 7 times at 55 yards with pretty good success. He passed the curiosity around for examination. It went off accidentally. The ball passed through the hat of a woman about 40 yards off, cutting her temple. She fell instantly, and the blood gushing from her temple. We were all in the greatest consternation, supposed she was dead, but in a minute she revived to our inexpressible satisfaction, and by examination we found the wound by no means mortal or even dangerous. Never again did he pass the air gun around when it was pumped up and loaded. The expedition returned to the river. After a mile or so, we were obliged to get out all hands and lift the boat over about 30 yards. Then another ripple, and another. The captain got out too and pulled or lifted. Twice. A third time. Fortunately, the water was temperate, but when Lewis had the boat put ashore for the night, having gone only 10 miles downstream, he was much fatigued after laboring with my men all day, gave my men some whiskey, and retired to rest at 8 o'clock. That was the first entry in what became the journals of Lewis and Clark. The journals are one of America's literary treasures. Throughout, they tell their story in fascinating detail. They have a driving narrative that is compelling, yet they pause for little asides and anecdotes that make them a delight to read. Their images are so sharp, they all but force the reader to put down the book, close the eyes, and see what the captain saw, hear what they heard. The journals never flash back or forward. From start to finish, they stick to the present. The more closely they are read, the greater the reward. Theodore Roosevelt, no stranger to adventure, said this about the journals. Few explorers who saw and did so much that was absolutely new have written of their deeds with such quiet absence of boastfulness, and have drawn their descriptions with such complete freedom from exaggeration. It is not known when Lewis made entries in the journals, not even the first entry. Did Lewis write it that night, before blowing out his candle, or the next morning on the boat, or a week or so later at a weather-enforced halt? There is an extensive literature on the subject, capped by an essay by Gary Moulton in the introduction to Volume 2 of the modern edition of the journals. Moulton concludes, "Most of the material we now have was written by the captains in the course of the expedition." Not all, just most. Moulton adds that it cannot be said when during the expedition the entries were written, whether on the day of the event or a few days or even a few months later. Never mind. As Moulton remarks in reading the journals, we are in a sense traveling with the captains and sharing their day-by-day experiences and uncertainties. There is another more important and tantalizing mystery. Lewis began his journal the day he began the expedition, August 31st, 1803. He was a faithful recorder of flora and fauna, weather, the difficulties of getting down the river, unusual occurrences, people encountered. The journal, a combination travelogue and record, a description of matters new to science and of geography, and much more, obviously meant a great deal to him, and he was well aware of its importance to the success of the expedition. And he clearly enjoyed writing, thinking through the events of the day and sorting them out and making sense out of them in very long, very complex sentences that often threatened to get completely out of control but were always rescued by the last verb. Geographer Paul Russell Cutright speaks of Lewis's recurrent artistry in stringing apt words together colorfully, and notes that among his virtues as a writer were his sizable working vocabulary, his quietly authoritative statements, his active, unrestrained interest in all natural phenomena, his consistent adherence to truth, and above all, his wide command of adjectives, verbs, and nouns, which repeatedly give color to his sentences. Yet there are long periods, months at a time, nearly a year in one case, for which few and only sporadic journal entries by Lewis are known to exist. These gaps include September 19th to November 11th, 1803, May 14th, 1804 to April 7th, 1805, August 26th, 1805 to January 1st, 1806, and from August 12th to the end of September, 1806. There is no explanation for the gaps. Possibly he was depressed, or maybe it was just a severe case of writer's block. Neither explanation seems likely, however. In any event, as Moulton warns, no one is ready to say that no Lewis journal exists for those gaps, because scholars are always discovering new documentation about the expedition. So maybe the entries Lewis made for those dates are just lost, but that too seems unlikely because of internal evidence and because there exists no known letter lamenting the loss of daily journals kept by Lewis, either at the time or after his death. Meanwhile, we are grateful for what we do have. On the morning of September 1st, fog over the river kept Lewis and his party ashore until 8 a.m. Lewis took care to load as much as possible in the pirogue, to lighten the load in the boat, but nevertheless ripples and shoals forced him again and again to unload and then lift the empty boat over the obstacle. At the last ripple of the day, Lewis was forced to seek out a local pioneer and hire a team of oxen to pull the boat off. The expedition made but 10 miles. September 2nd was a repeat performance. The water was the lowest ever seen on the Ohio, sometimes but 6 inches deep, so low and clear Lewis could see catfish, pike, bass, and sturgeon swimming. Struck again, Lewis went ashore to hire a horse and an ox. Paid the man his charge, which was $1, Lewis noted in his journal. Then he passed his judgment on the Ohio River pioneers, circa 1803. The inhabitants who live near these riffles live much by the distressed situation of the traveler. They are generally lazy, charge extravagantly when they are called on for assistance, and have no philanthropy or conscience. On the 3rd, at dawn, the air temperature was 63, that of the river 75. Lewis noted that the fog thus produced is impenetrably thick at this moment, one of the few times Lewis makes a reference to his precise time of writing. The party made 6 miles that day. Lewis discharged one of the men for reasons unstated. The following day, Lewis purchased another pirogue for $11. He was cheated. It leaked badly. Goods got wet. Guns began to rust. The party pulled over and spent the afternoon airing the articles, oiling the rifles, putting perishables into oilcloth bags, and otherwise repairing the damage. Lewis hired another hand to replace the man dismissed. On September 6th, the wind came up strong from the north in a stretch of river free of ripples. Lewis hoisted the foresail on the mast and experienced the inexpressible joy of running downstream with a wind dead astern and a good sail to catch the power of that wind. "We run 2 miles in a few minutes," Lewis wrote, almost unbelieving. Unfortunately, the wind strengthened to the point where Lewis was obliged to haul in the sail lest it carry away the mast. At the next ripple, the exhilaration gave way to consternation. Lewis hoisted the mainsail on the mast to run the stuck boat over the ripple, only to break the crosspiece. "My men worn down by perpetual lifting," Lewis wrote, "I was obliged again to have recourse to horses or oxen." He went to Steubenville, on the Ohio bank of the river, and found it a small, well-built, thriving place, has several respectable families residing in it, 5 years since it was a wilderness. He got the oxen and soon was afloat again. He concluded his entry with the sad news that, on the day during which he had covered 2 miles in but a few minutes, his total mileage for that day was but 10. On September 7th, he reached Wheeling, Virginia, which he found to be a pretty considerable village of 50 houses. He dined that evening with Dr. William Patterson, son of the Robert Patterson of Philadelphia, who had been one of Lewis's teachers. Young Patterson was enthusiastic about Lewis's expedition. "He expressed a great desire to go with me," Lewis recorded, and Lewis was receptive, at least in part because Patterson had the largest collection of medicines west of the mountains, a pharmacy worth £100. Lewis told Patterson that a doctor was not authorized, but if he went on to St. Louis, where Lewis expected to spend the winter, there would be an opportunity to get Jefferson's authorization for Patterson to join the party. This was Lewis's first admission that he would not have time to ascend the Missouri River for any distance at all before winter set in. Progress down the Ohio was so excruciatingly slow, he had to adjust. But he was eager to get going. Lewis told Patterson to be ready by 3 o'clock p.m. on September 9th, and they'd be off together. "Wouldn't miss it for the world," the doctor replied. In Wheeling, Lewis picked up the shipment of rifles and ammunition he had sent overland from Pittsburgh and found it in good order. To carry it, he purchased another pirogue. That took up the better part of the day on September 9th. By mid-afternoon, everything was finally packed and ready to go, but no sign of Dr. Patterson. Lewis shoved off. That night, he opened his journal entry on a laconic note. "The doctor could not get ready. I waited until 3 this evening and then set out." Thus did Dr. Patterson miss the Lewis and Clark expedition. It was undoubtedly just as well. His reputation was one of constant drunkenness, which may well have been the cause of his being late. That night, the rain came down in torrents. Lewis covered the pirogues with oilcloth to no avail. He was up past midnight in the cold rain, wet to the skin. Finally, "I wrung out my saturated clothes, put on a dry shirt, and turned into my berth." In the morning, he stopped at an Indian earth mound on the Virginia bank and described it in considerable detail. Even with the stop, he made his best distance to date, 24 miles, because the river below Wheeling was relatively free of riffles and other obstructions. The next day, September 11th, it was 26 miles. The highlight of the day was a performance by Seaman, Lewis's Newfoundland, described by Lewis as "very active, strong, and docile." Squirrels were migrating across the Ohio River, north to south, for reasons obscure to Lewis, since their principal food, hickory nuts, was in abundance on both banks. Seaman started barking at them. Lewis let him go. Seaman swam out, grabbed a squirrel, killed him, and fetched him back to Lewis, who sent the dog out for repeated performances. Lewis had the squirrels fried and declared they were fat and, I thought, a pleasant food. On the morning of September 13th, Lewis saw another natural history phenomenon: passenger pigeons flying over the river north to south on their migration. They flew in such great flocks they obscured the sun. The river he was descending continued to broaden and deepen. It still sparkled in the sunlight, especially as the angle of the sun on the water became more acute with the shorter days. The water was dark, almost black, after the recent heavy rains. The banks were lined with hardwoods, deep green, enclosing. All the sounds on the river, other than the splash of the oars, were from nature's chorus, frogs and birds mainly, and the wind through the trees. Although clearings were rare and villages even rarer, this was not wilderness. Lewis and at least some of the men in the boat party had been down the river before, as had thousands of other Americans. It had been mapped, so Lewis had no reason to use his instruments to determine longitude and latitude. Still, it was wild enough to suit. When Lewis pulled into Marietta at 2 p.m., he was in high spirits. He wrote a report to Jefferson, outlining his progress since Wheeling, describing his several methods for getting over obstructions, and indulging himself in a little joke. "Horses or oxen are the last resort. I find them the most efficient sailors in the riffles, although they may be considered somewhat clumsy." Marietta, founded in 1788, was the oldest settlement in Ohio. Only a handful of children had been born there. Indeed, only a few adult residents had been born in Ohio. Lewis spent a night there. He dismissed two of the men, for unstated reasons, reducing his party to a dozen. He had a visit with Colonel Griffin Green, one of the founders of Marietta, and an excellent Republican. That last qualification had gotten Green the appointment as postmaster. Two men got drunk in the village and failed to report back to the boat. In the morning, Lewis went looking for them, found them so drunk that they were unable to help themselves, had them picked up and thrown into the boat, and set off. As the expedition got lower on the river, it entered country in which, Lewis wrote on September 14th, the fever and ague and bilious fevers commence their baneful oppression and continue through the whole course of the river with increasing violence as you approach its mouth. Lewis was referring to malaria, which was endemic in the Ohio, Mississippi, and lower Missouri valleys. He knew it well from his experiences on the Ohio during his travelers as paymaster and anticipated it. Malaria was the most common disease in the country, especially on the frontier, where it was so inescapable that many refused to regard it as a disease. Like hard work, it was just a part of life. Jefferson had it. It may have been the illness that forced Clark to resign his commission in 1796. No one knew what caused malaria. Dr. Rush's opinion was bad air, rising from swamps. He was on the edge of seeing the mosquito as the culprit, but never quite got there. The good doctor was helping one of his University of Pennsylvania graduate students in his research. S. Firth was doing his thesis on causation of malaria. The general view was that epidemics resulted from contagion, meaning the fevers were transmitted by direct contact between people. Firth wanted to see whether this was true. Firth's research methods were crude, heroic, and reckless. They demonstrated the almost total ignorance that the best-trained specialists of the era wallowed in, with regard to disease. As in means of transportation, mankind had made virtually no progress in the previous 2,000 years. Firth inhaled vapors from black vomit taken from malaria or yellow fever patients. He injected the vomit into the stomachs and veins of cats and dogs, and into his own body. Neither the cats and dogs nor Firth got malaria. He completed his research in June 1804 and reported his conclusion. The autumnal disease, yet another name for malaria, was not contagious. Whether Lewis met Firth is unknown. That Lewis talked about malaria with Dr. Rush is apparent, because he spent one-third of his medical budget on the purchase of Peruvian bark for his armamentarium. For the $30, Lewis got 15 pounds of the Peruvian bark. It came from a South American tree and contained many alkaloids, the most important being quinine and quinidine. Lewis had it in a powder form. It was considered sovereign for malaria, and rightly so. Later in the 19th century, quinine became the drug of choice for the disease. One medical historian calls it the drug that changed the destinies of nations, because it alone made possible the invasion and exploitation of tropical countries. Quinine copes with, rather than completely cures, the disease. Recurrences are common to sufferers. The best preventive was to avoid getting bitten by infected mosquitoes. Easier said than done, of course. Even had he known that it was the mosquitoes transmitting the malaria, Lewis could have done little about it. He had armed himself for the war against mosquitoes. In Philadelphia, he had purchased mosquito curtains and 8 pounds catgut for mosquito curtains and 200 pounds of tallow mixed with 50 pounds of hog's lard. The lard served a double purpose, insect repellent and a base for pemmican. Lewis took mosquitoes seriously, but his preparations were entirely defensive. Neither he nor anyone else alive in 1803 had the slightest idea how to take the offensive against them. Nor did anyone understand how serious was the battle against them. Lewis thought of the mosquitoes as a pest, not a threat. Nor did he ever learn how to spell his enemy's name. His usual spelling, repeated at least 25 times, was M-U-S-Q-U-E-T-O-E. Clark was more inventive. He had at least 20 variations, ranging from M-E-S-Q-U-E-T-O-R-S through M-I-S-Q-U-T-R to M-U-S-Q-U-E-T-O-R-S. In many ways, the trip down the Ohio was a shakedown voyage for the boat and pirogues. Getting the packing right, for example, was a constant learning process. On September 15th, it rained hard for 6 hours. Lewis kept paddling and made 18 miles. The following day it was 19 miles, but by dusk, my men were very much fatigued. The next morning the expedition came to a long sandbar. It was a handsome, clean place, so Lewis decided to spend the day opening and drying his goods, which I had found were wet by the rain on the 15th. Even though he had wrapped them securely in oilcloths and had the canoes constantly baled during the course of the day. The guns, tomahawks, and knives were rusting. Lewis had them oiled and exposed to the sun. Clothing of every description also was opened and aired. All hands, including the captains, were kept busy in this enterprise from 10 o'clock a.m. to sunset, when Lewis had the canoes reloaded, this time paying more attention to getting vulnerable items up off the canoe bottom. From Marietta, it was about 100 miles southeast to the point where Ohio, Virginia, and Kentucky joined, then another 100 or so to Cincinnati. The river was deep, the weather fine. Lewis covered the 200 miles in 2 weeks without incident. He stayed in the Cincinnati area for a week to rest his men, take on provisions, do some research for Jefferson, and write two letters. The first was to Clark in Louisville in reply to a letter of August 21st, which Lewis had just picked up. Clark reported that he had many applicants for the expedition, from stout, likely fellows, but he was putting them on hold until Lewis got to Louisville and could look them over. Clark pointed out what he knew Lewis already knew, that a judicious choice of our party is of the greatest importance to the success of this vast enterprise. On a more general note, Clark concluded, I am happy to hear of the cession of Louisiana to the United States. This is an inestimable treasure to the Western people, who appear to feel its value. Lewis responded by reporting his progress and discussing the selection of men for the voyage up the Missouri. He said he liked Clark's ideas on the need for a judicious selection, and that he had two young men with him, taken on trial, conditionally only, though I think they will answer tolerably well. Apparently he meant John Coulter and George Shannon. Obviously he meant that Clark would have a veto over his choices, just as he would over Clark's. Lewis and Clark had not been together in 7 years, but even before they met, their partnership was flourishing, their trust in each other's judgment complete. There were no perils in divided command for this pair. The second letter was to Jefferson. Lewis reported on his visit to Big Bone Lick, Kentucky, some 20 miles southwest of Cincinnati. Earlier in the year, Dr. William Goforth had discovered there the bones of a mammoth. Evidently, Jefferson had urged Lewis to visit the site. Lewis did, and sent in a mammoth report on the mammoth, including 2,064 words to describe a tusk of an immense size, along with some specimens of bones. Lewis asked the president to send him some of the vaccine matter, as I have reason to believe from several experiments made with what I have that it has lost its virtue. He intended to use it to vaccinate against the smallpox. This, too, was a favorite subject of Jefferson's, who had sponsored the use of the cowpox and had inoculated himself and his family. The wording of the letter indicates that it was Jefferson who had provided Lewis with cowpox to bring to the frontier and to the Indians, and instructed him in its use. The big problem, as Lewis's request reflects, was keeping the vaccine alive. When no scab formed where Lewis scratched the cowpox vaccine into a patient's arm, Lewis knew it was no longer virile. Lewis concluded his letter to Jefferson with a statement of intentions. As this session of Congress has commenced, he began, and as for a variety of reasons his progress had been delayed, and feeling as I do in the most anxious manner a wish to keep them, the politicians, in a good humor on the subject of the expedition in which I am engaged, I have concluded to make a tour this winter on horseback of some 100 miles through the most interesting portion of the country adjoining my winter establishment. He said he would go up the Kansas River toward Santa Fe, and he proposed to have Clark make his own excursion through some other portion of the country. That way, by the end of February, he would be able to send Jefferson such information relative to that country which, if it does not produce a conviction of the utility of the project, will at least procure the further toleration of the expedition. Here was the president's aide at work, a zealot protecting his boss from the Federalist jackals in Congress. Here was the partisan politician trying to give his party a winning issue in the upcoming 1804 presidential campaign. Here, too, was the young adventurer, resigned to having to build a winter camp near St. Louis rather than getting on up the Missouri a few hundred miles, his mind alive with possibilities during the brilliant fall afternoons on the Ohio, refusing to submit to the anticipated dullness of an Army camp life for 5 months. But alive though his mind was, here was a young man who had not thought things through. This was the first Jefferson knew that Lewis had abandoned hope of getting up the Missouri before winter. He accepted the decision, indeed endorsed it heartily, because he wanted Lewis to spend the winter gathering information in St. Louis, not out on the Kansas prairie, and because the expedition could draw its rations from the U.S. Army posts on the Mississippi, thus not depleting the stores for the voyage. So, as Commander-in-Chief, Jefferson had said directly to Lewis, "I leave it to your own judgment as to where to spend the winter." Not that the President had a lot of choice. The mails moved so slowly there was not the slightest possibility of Jefferson's giving Lewis orders that could arrive in time to be acted on. Jefferson did not receive Lewis's letter until mid-November. His reply did not reach Lewis until January. Still, Jefferson tried to take control because he was so alarmed by Lewis's proposal to set off on a midwinter exploration toward Santa Fe, into the part of the continent clearly Spanish and, because of its gold and silver mines, a part about which the Spanish were extremely sensitive. The great danger involved led Jefferson to issue a direct order, hoping it would arrive in time. "You must not undertake the winter excursion which you propose in yours of October 3rd. Lewis's proposal caused Jefferson great worry, not just about the dangers, but about Lewis's judgment. Thus, there is a note of suppressed alarm in his response. He could hardly remove Lewis from the command, but he could try to get Lewis to think of first things first. Jefferson wrote, "The object of your mission is single, the direct water communication from sea to sea formed by the bed of the Missouri and perhaps the Oregon." That was the most succinct statement about the purpose of the expedition Jefferson ever wrote. He explained that the dangers of a Santa Fe trip would be greater than those Lewis would face on the Missouri, because the Spanish armed forces would be almost certain to arrest and detain him if he went southwest, but leave him alone on the Missouri, since that was now American territory. As to Clark's proposed excursion, Jefferson wrote, "By leaving Mr. Clark with you, we consider the expedition double-manned, and therefore the less liable to failure, for which reason neither of you should be exposed to risks by going off of your line." The Louisiana Purchase had another impact on the goals of the expedition. Jefferson described the boundaries of Louisiana as "the high lands enclosing all the waters which run into the Mississippi or Missouri directly or indirectly." That was stretching the boundaries a bit, perhaps. No one really knew. But as Jefferson explained, "it therefore becomes interesting to fix with precision by celestial observations the longitude and latitude of the sources of those rivers." What he meant, or hoped for, was that northern tributaries of the Missouri would extend well north of the 49th parallel, deep into the fur-rich country of western Canada. If so, that territory wasn't western Canada. It was the property of the United States. Jefferson didn't want to risk not finding out because his young captain had indulged himself in a joyride. He concluded his letter by repeating his order that Lewis stick to his assigned missions, which were not to be delayed or hazarded by any episodes whatever. On October 4th or 5th, Lewis pushed his boat and pirogues back into the river and headed west for the falls of the Ohio, some 100 miles downstream. On October 14th, he was at the head of the falls, which were actually long rapids created by a 24-foot drop of the river over a 2-mile-long series of limestone ledges. At the foot of the rapids, on the north bank, was Clarksville, Indiana Territory. Louisville, Kentucky, was on the south bank. On October 15th, Lewis hired local pilots who took the boat and pirogues into the dangerous but passable passage on the north bank. Safely through, Lewis tied up at Clarksville and set off to meet his partner, who was living with his older brother, General George Rogers Clark. When they shook hands, the Lewis and Clark expedition began. Each man was about 6 feet tall and broad-shouldered. Each was rugged in the face, Clark somewhat more so than Lewis, who had a certain delicacy to his profile. Their bodies were raw-boned and muscled, with no fat. Their hands, sunburned like their faces, even this late in the season, were big, rough, strong, capable, confident. Each man was long-legged. Just a glimpse of their stride across a porch, or at how they seated themselves, showed the physical coordination of an athlete. Each, probably, was dressed in fringed buckskin. And who can doubt that as they stuck out their hands to each other, both men had smiles on their faces that were as broad as the Ohio River, as big as their ambitions and dreams. Oh, to have been able to hear the talk on the porch that afternoon, and on into the evening, and through the night. There would have been whiskey. General Clark was the host, and General Clark was a heavy drinker. There would have been tables groaning under the weight of pork, beef, venison, duck, goose, fish, fresh bread, apples, fresh milk, and more. There were the two would-be heroes with the authentic older hero, all three Virginians, all three soldiers, all three Republicans, all three great talkers, full of ideas and images and memories and practical matters and grand philosophy, of Indians and bears and mountains never before seen. Excitement and joy ran through their questions and answers, words coming out in a tumble. Unfortunately, we don't have a single word of description of the meeting of Lewis and Clark. Over the next 2 weeks, the captain selected the first enlisted members of the expedition. They did not lack for volunteers. Word had spread up and down the Ohio and inland, and young men, longing for adventure and ambitious for a piece of land of their own, set out for Clarksville to sign up. Lewis and Clark sized them up, making judgments on their general hardiness, their shooting and hunting ability, their physical strength and general character, their suitability for a long journey in the wilderness. How many applied is not known, but one of those eventually selected, Private Alexander Willard, boasted in his old age that his fine physique enabled him to pass the inspection for enlistment in the expedition that more than 100 others failed. 7 of the men the captains picked had previously been conditionally approved by Clark, 2 by Lewis. They made Charles Floyd and Nathaniel Pryor sergeants. Floyd was the son of Captain Charles Floyd, who had soldiered with George Rogers Clark. When these 9 men were sworn into the Army, in solemn ceremony, in the presence of General Clark, the Corps of Discovery was born. In addition to the enlisted men, the Corps consisted of the captains, and Clark's slave, York. York was big, very dark, strong, agile, a natural athlete. About Clark's age, or a bit younger, he had been Clark's lifelong companion, bequeathed to him by his father, whose companion had in turn been York's father. Certainly, the captains discussed the size of the expedition. Secretary of War Dearborn had authorized 12 enlisted men and an interpreter, but Jefferson had orally given Lewis authorization to engage any other men, not soldiers, that I may think useful. Back in 1783, General Clark had advised Jefferson that if the American Philosophical Society did send out an expedition to explore the Missouri country, they should keep it small, a dozen at most, because any larger party would arouse the Indians to hostile acts. In 1803, he may have repeated that advice to his younger brother and Captain Lewis, but if he did, they ignored it. They intended a much larger party. According to a locally written newspaper story, it was said around Louisville that about 60 men will compose the party. How many of them would be soldiers attached to the Corps of Discovery? How many soldiers who would go only as far as the first winter camp? How many civilians hired to power the keelboat was to be determined. In any event, the Corps of Discovery had been formed, and the captains were pleased with the stout young fellows they had picked. The keelboat and pirogues set off from Clarksville on October 26th. There was plenty of water and no obstacles. On November 11th, the party arrived at Fort Massac, built 10 years earlier on the Illinois bank of the Ohio, about 35 miles upstream from the junction of the Ohio and the Mississippi. There, Lewis expected to find 8 soldiers who had volunteered from the Army camp at Southwest Post, Tennessee, but they hadn't been seen. Lewis immediately hired George Driard, a locally renowned woodsman, to go to Tennessee, pick up the missing soldiers, and bring them on to winter quarters, which he should look for on the east bank of the Mississippi near St. Louis. Although he never learned how to spell Driard's name, it usually came out Druyer, Lewis was impressed by him from the start. Son of a French-Canadian father and a Shawnee mother, Driard was a skilled frontiersman, hunter-trapper, and scout. He was an expert in Indian ways, fluent in a couple of Indian languages and in French and English, and master of the sign language. He exuded a calm confidence, giving the strong impression that no matter what happened, he could handle it. Lewis signed him to a contract to serve as interpreter at $25 per month, and arranged for the paymaster at Massac to advance him $30 in coin. Though Lewis was authorized to draw volunteers from the garrison at Fort Massac, he was disappointed in the quality of the men who stepped forward. Only two met his standards. On November 13th, the expedition set off from Massac. There was a heavy rain. "I was seized with a violent ague," Lewis wrote in his journal, "which continued about 4 hours and, as is usual, was succeeded by a fever which, however fortunately, abated in some measure by sunrise." He had malaria. When he woke, "I took a dose of Rush's pills which operated extremely well." The fever passed. That night, the party landed on the point at which the Ohio and Mississippi flowed together. For the following week, Lewis and Clark made measurements and conducted celestial observation. With his measuring chain and circumferenter, or surveying compass, Clark determined by triangulation that the width of the Ohio at the point just before junction was 1,274 yards, that of the Mississippi 1,435 yards, and of the combined rivers 2,002 yards. During the encampment at the mouth of the Ohio, Lewis began to apply the lessons he had learned in Philadelphia on celestial observation, and simultaneously to teach Clark what he knew. Establishing latitude was complicated but doable in the field. Using the octant in the summer, or the sextant, winter, Lewis would shoot the sun at noon and take its altitude. He would then consult a table to determine latitude. The angle of the sun at high noon, together with the date, would tell him for certain how far north of the equator he was. Determining longitude was almost impossibly complicated. If Lewis knew it was high noon in Greenwich, and he knew exactly what time it was where he was, he could figure out his longitude. But to know the time in Greenwich required an accurate chronometer. Though Lewis had bought the best available in Philadelphia, it was not reliable. The alternative was to note the regular movement of the moon, measured against the sun and stars. The method was to choose a bright star as a fixed point against which to measure the moon's easterly motion in its orbit around the Earth. The stars that could be used for the measurement were Antares, Altair, Regulus, Spica, Pollux, Aldebaran, Fomalhaut, Alphi, Arietis, and Alplopagus. Lewis could identify those stars and many others, a skill that he had absorbed in the course of his life. He had spent countless nights stretched out in the open, countless hours staring at the stars. He had enjoyed the privilege of walking the grounds after dark at the President's House and at Monticello with Thomas Jefferson for his guide to the skies. The skill also grew out of his character. His intense curiosity compelled him to study the world around him and the sky above him. His crash course in Philadelphia enabled him to make the observations. It was complicated. With the sextant, every few minutes he would measure the angular distance between the moon and the target star. The figures obtained could be compared with tables showing how those distances appeared at the same clock time in Greenwich. Those tables were too heavy to carry on the expedition, and the work was too time-consuming. Since Lewis's job was to make the observations and bring them home, he did not try to do the calculations. He and Clark just gathered the figures. It meant staying up till midnight, making observations every 5 minutes or so for an hour or more. It meant frustration on those nights, too frequent, when clouds came up to render observation impossible. The sky over the dark, murmuring river was black and transparent, free of any pollutants, far from any glowing village. Behind the captains, the men slept in their tents, the quiet sleep of healthy young men exhausted from the day's labors. The private on guard duty kept a small fire burning. Lewis's dog sat beside him as he called out the numbers for Clark. This was practice, the longitude and latitude of the mouth of the Ohio were known, but Lewis and Clark worked at it as if it were the real thing, because soon enough it would be. Seaman was always with Lewis. On the afternoon of November 16th, the captains crossed to the Spanish side of the Mississippi to make observations. They encountered a camp of Indians. One of them, a respectable-looking Indian, offered Lewis 3 beaver skins for seamen. Lewis refused with considerable indignation. He pointed out that he had paid $20 in cash for the dog. Besides, Lewis wrote, "I prized seaman much for his docility and qualifications generally for my journey." On November 18th, Lewis complained that the men had discovered a nearby illegal trading post with whiskey as the main trade item. He issued orders to stay away, but a number of the men went anyway and got drunk. Whiskey and whiskey traders were the bane of frontier life. Lewis had to anticipate more trouble with drinking during the long winter nights coming up. On November 20th, the expedition set out for St. Louis. Now it was headed upstream, and would continue to labor upstream until it reached the Continental Divide, somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. Chapter 10. Up the Mississippi to Winter Camp, November 1803 to March 1804. The expedition headed out into the Mississippi, then turned upstream. Lewis and Clark scholar Arlen Large speculates that this may have been the instant when the captains decided they needed more men. The power of that river, with its boils and swirls and floating obstacles, awed them. Back east, Robert Fulton was doing his first experiments with a steamboat, but on the Mississippi, the expedition was proceeding at a pace closer to that of the first century than to the age of steamboats. Lewis now was face to face with what would be his major problem almost until he reached the Continental Divide, moving relatively large craft upstream on a major river. The pirogues were badly undermanned. The keelboat was woefully so. They had to cross the river, east to west, west to east, at every bend, because only in the relatively slack water downstream from a point of land could they make any significant progress north. In 8 hours of constant rowing or paddling, the expedition made 10.5 miles. Much more muscle power was needed. In addition, one man would have to stay constantly at the bow of the keelboat, watching for huge uprooted trees rushing downstream on the boiling current. More men would require more supplies. Lewis had a lot to think about while the men dug in for all they were worth as the tiny fleet slowly inched its way north. He and Clark were not men who made snap judgments, but in this case it is likely that Arlen Large got it right. They decided on the first day to expand the party by more than 100%. Over the next few days, the men worked the craft upstream, seldom making more than 1 mile per hour. Even more maddening, the river twisted and turned to such an extent that the 25 air miles to Cape Girardeau were 48 river miles. It took 4 days to reach the Cape. The village had been founded by Louis Lorimier some 20 years earlier. A French-Canadian, he had been a loyalist during the Revolution and had fought George Rogers Clark, who had burned down one of his establishments, worth $20,000. This broke him as a merchant, Lewis noted in his journal on November 25th, but Lorimier was a high-risk-taking, fast-talking, hard-bargaining, vigorous and ambitious frontier entrepreneur, a man who could recover from disaster. After General Clark burned him out, Lorimier talked the Spanish into giving him a land grant on the west bank of the river. He built a trading post at Cape Girardeau. He encouraged American immigration into the area, which consequently flourished. Lewis called on Lorimier and was told that the boss was at a horse race. Lewis went to the course. The scene reminded me very much of their small races in Kentucky among the uncivilized backwoodsmen. Nor did the subsequent disorder which took place in consequences of the decision of the judges of the race at all lessen the resemblance. It is not extraordinary that these people should be disorderly. They are almost entirely immigrant from the frontiers of Kentucky and Tennessee, and are the most dissolute and abandoned even among these people. They are men of desperate fortunes, but little to lose either character or property. Lorimier, on the other hand, intrigued him. Nearly 60 years old, he could not read or write. He had a remarkable suit of hair. It touched the ground when he stood erect. When sewed, it is kept close to his back by means of a leather girdle. Lorimier's wife was a Shawnee woman. He had many children by her, including a daughter who caught Lewis's eye. She is remarkably handsome, and dresses in a plain yet fashionable style, or such as is now common in the Atlantic states, among the respectable people of the middle class. She is an agreeable, affable girl, and much the most decent-looking female I have seen since I left Louisville. On November 28th, the expedition reached the army post at Kaskaskia, on the Illinois side, some 60 miles below St. Louis. It was home to Captain Russell Bissell's infantry company and to Captain Amos Stoddard's artillery company. Lewis's first act was to show the captains his orders from Dearborn, authorizing him to raid their companies. Then he called for volunteers and made his selections. The exact number is not known. Arlen Large thinks it was something more than a dozen. Not all would go all the way to the Pacific. Lewis was thinking of sending a detachment back to St. Louis from the Mandan villages, where he anticipated spending the winter of 1804-5. Lewis also requisitioned Stoddard for 75 pounds of powder and a cask to hold it. On December 4th, Clark set out with the boat party, headed for the mouth of Wood River, upstream from St. Louis on the Illinois side, directly opposite the mouth of the Missouri. The word was that it was well timbered, with plenty of game and a nearby settlement of pioneers. Lewis traveled up the Illinois bank by horseback. He arrived at the village of Cahokia, almost directly across from St. Louis, on December 7th. The next morning, Lewis crossed the river to St. Louis, along with Nicholas Jarrett, a Cahokia fur trader, as interpreter to meet the Spanish Lieutenant Governor of Upper Louisiana, Colonel Carlos de Holt de Lassus. The meeting had some rough spots. De Lassus denied Lewis permission to go up the Missouri until the transfer of sovereignty had taken place in St. Louis. Lewis did not argue the point. It was too late in the season to press on anyway, and Lewis needed to be near St. Louis to purchase supplies for the extra men. Lewis told de Lassus that his objective was to explore the Missouri country, purely for scientific purposes. De Lassus, in a report to his superiors, said he had heard different. "According to advices, I believe that his